This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 30 was recorded on September 8th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Precious metals caught me by surprise this week, with gold touching $1,357, up more than $50 an ounce from its intraday low just a week earlier. Silver briefly traded above $20 this week, which I sure wasn't expecting. So we're taking advantage of the opportunity to bring back renowned precious metals expert Jeffrey Christian as this week's featured interview guest. In addition to the precious metals outlook, Jeff and I will also be discussing a number of macro factors ranging from treasury yields to excess bank reserves to inflation versus deflation. All of that and more is coming up in this week's featured interview. After our feature interview with Jeff, Aaron and I will be discussing reserve currencies, what they are, how they work, and why the U.S. dollar's role as de facto global reserve currency is so important.
And I'm Aaron Chan. For the second week in a row, the S&P 500 stock index did not, I repeat, did not break out to yet another all-time record high. And somehow, the fact it didn't actually seems like news after so many weeks of new all-time highs. Eric, could this be the beginning of the end for the stock market, as so many notables like George Soros and Carl Icahn have predicted?
Well, I don't know about that, but what I would say is markets generally don't crash when a lot of people are predicting that they will. So is it possible that this was a top and it's all headed downhill from here? I suppose that's possible. What I will predict is that we're not going to see a sudden and dramatic crash. And the reason I say that is simply if you understand the mechanics of how a stock market crash happens, it's when nobody's expecting it and all of the sudden some catalyst causes a loss of confidence and everybody starts panicking and selling because they're not hedged. The thing is, so many people have been talking about how precarious these valuations are for so long that a lot of people have hedges on. Carl Icahn has been very vocal about saying he's more hedged than he's ever been before. So I don't think that the ingredients exist for a sudden and unexpected market crash precisely because so many people are predicting exactly that outcome. And, you know, the other thing is, where are we this week? 10 points or so below that all-time high from a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, maybe we're seeing a topping process here. I don't know. But I certainly don't see the ingredients for a sudden and dramatic crash, despite the chorus of voices that are saying that's coming. I could be wrong, but I just don't see the market unexpectedly crashing at a time when too many people are predicting that outcome.
Right. And on our Labor Day weekend oil market special last week, you and Art Berman both predicted that some really big inventory builds might be coming this fall. So any sign of that yet, Eric?
Well, I think in that show I said specifically that I was expecting some really large inventory builds. I think I may have mentioned the number 5 million barrels in a single week. So if I were to tell you that this week's number was actually 14.5 million barrels, that is the biggest one-week change in inventory ever since 1999. So that's 17 years. Boy, I would look like a genius for saying that. Until, wait a minute, let's give it a couple more seconds. I like sounding like a genius. Let's let that sink in. Okay, now we have to reveal the news. It was a 14.5 million barrel drawdown on inventory, the opposite direction of what Art and I predicted. Meanwhile, Cushing, Oklahoma, always critical because it's where the WTI futures contract is settled, drawdown 434,000 barrels. More space available in Cushing this week than last week. Gasoline, meanwhile, massive 4.2 million barrel drawdown on inventories, offset by a very large build on distillate inventories of 3.4 million barrels and a slight decline in production 3 weeks in a row. Well, boy, listening to just drawdown after drawdown after drawdown sounds like Art and I really screwed up and got it wrong. Well, hold on, guys. This is almost, you know, I don't want to say almost certainly. This is absolutely, without a doubt, a weather-related anomaly in the data. Tropical storm Hermine in the Gulf is resulting in shut-ins. It's resulted in the lowest level of imports of crude oil to the United States on record ever in a single week. Well, what's going on? Did those ships that were coming not come? Did they sink at sea? No, they're still stuck at sea because of bad weather. They're still coming. They're delayed by a week or two until the weather gets better. So I think that this massive, massive drawdown in inventory is an anomaly that is a result of weather. And of course, there's a real impact from these weather events. You know, they screw the system up. But for the most part, it's a delay effect. The oil's still coming. So, yeah, we saw this massive drawdown. We'll see a big build when the weather clears. I don't think it's a big deal. Meanwhile, West Texas Intermediate crude oil rallying dramatically, a dollar instantly within the first 2 seconds of that inventory number coming out, and more than a dollar and a half in the ensuing few hours after that. It's as if the bulls are just jumping for joy that this inventory number has changed everything. It's changed everything until the weather clears, guys. So I really don't think it's nearly as significant as the tape action is suggesting. But we're looking at 47 spot 41. We were at $44 and change before First API reported the large draw. They were anticipating a 12 million barrel draw, and then DOE confirmed it at 14.5. And, you know, the market has just been going straight up. It's the weather. Pay attention, people. I don't think this will last, but it probably will last until we get another inventory report. Will it be a big build on inventory next week? Depends on how long the weather takes to clear.
All right, so shifting over to gold, we've been watching a technical consolidation range between 1308 and 1377 for so long now that our regular listeners are probably sick of hearing me say that over and over again. But last week, it looked like we were right on the precipice of a breakdown below key support at 1308, and we even saw 1306 briefly on an intraday basis. Now, Eric, I was pretty sure this week we'd be discussing the breakdown below 1308, but it went the other way, trading as high as 1357 this week. So what's your outlook for gold here?
Well, definitely, it's taken me by surprise. I think that, you know, the combination of the dollar weakness resulting from the jobs report, non-farm payrolls last Friday, rate hike expectations are weakening, and of course, if you don't hike rates, that's the competitor to gold because treasuries offer, most people think, similar safety, although I would disagree with that myself, and they produce a yield. If that yield is going up, it's competing with gold. If it's not going up, it's not competing with gold. So that explains the short-term tape action. But the more important question is, you know, when Jeff Christian was last on our program in May, he and I both thought this market was rolling back over towards 1200 or so, and that clearly has not happened. Looking at about 1341 right now as we speak, and as you mentioned, testing 1357 earlier this week. Clearly, this calls for an expert. So let's save the rest of the gold conversation for our feature interview with Jeff Christian, who's going to have a whole lot more to say about it.
Yeah, sounds good. 10-year Treasury yields are about where they were last week. Price to yield about 1.60 on Thursday afternoon. Any change in your outlook, Eric?
Not really. I guess what I would say, as I've said before, is my initial post-Brexit opinion, which is maybe this is just a quick dead cat bounce post-Brexit and we're going to see lower yields. I still think we're headed towards lower yields, but it's clear now that it's not just a dead cat bounce. It's going to take longer to play out. And I think really we've got to see some resolution of, you know, will she or won't she? Is Janet Yellen really going to hike rates ever? And if so, when is that going to happen? It looks like it's probably not at the September meeting at this point, or at least expectations of that are collapsing. We'll see what happens.
Right. And we've been expecting more U.S. dollar strength, but really the chart looks awfully soft, back to a 94 handle again. So what's going on with the dollar?
Well, of course, it is the result of the non-farm payroll report and the expectations of a rate hike collapsing. And I think that's the reason we're seeing the dollar softness. And of course, the mechanism of injury there is that when you hike interest rates, it makes the dollar more competitive with other currencies, brings international capital in. If you're not expecting that rate hike to happen, the capital inflows don't happen and the dollar weakens. So it's all very much to be expected in reaction to the news that we've had, and I'm going to definitely ask Jeff Christian again for his view, because he's certainly been more right than I have on the dollar in the last year.
So thanks for the market update, Eric. CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian is one of the most renowned precious metals experts in the industry, so we're delighted to have him back on the program to shed some light on the unexpected strength in the gold market since we last interviewed him back in May. Eric's interview with Mr. Christian is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is CPM Group founder and renowned precious metals expert Jeff Christian. Jeff, of course, is best known for his precious metals work. But Jeff, I'd like to start with a couple of macro backdrop issues before we get on to gold and silver, which I'm sure our listeners are looking forward to hearing your view on. So let's start with the U.S. dollar. The last time we had you on the show, my view was I was expecting the U.S. dollar rally to continue. You said you thought it was more likely to kind of muddle along and tread water. And I guess you got the call on that one because that's exactly what's happened. So since you got it right, what do you see from here in terms of the U.S. dollar, because obviously gold and everything else is priced in dollars?
Well, I think that the dollar will continue to tread water. You know, I think there is an upward bias on the dollar, but you know, one of the things that we were looking, expecting to limit the dollar's upward momentum was that we thought that investors would be cycling away from investing so heavily in the U.S. market, and they would be moving back to a more balanced global focus on their investment portfolio. And in the first half of this year, we didn't necessarily see that, but I think that in the third quarter, we've seen investors starting to shift. You know, they're not abandoning investments in the U.S. by any shake of the wand, but we are seeing investors starting to reinvest in emerging markets in Europe and China and in other economies, which is, I think, removing some of the upward pressure on the U.S. dollar. And we think that those trends are going to continue so that we don't necessarily see the dollar rising sharply, don't necessarily see it collapsing, but we see it sort of moving sideways in a relatively more volatile fashion than it has been over the last 4 months.
The other item that I wanted to touch on is European exit contagion, because quite a few people, at least the side of the argument that thinks that exit contagion is a serious risk, are saying that that's going to be maybe the next big catalyst for precious metals. So do you think that there is serious risk of Brexit leading to other nations leaving the European Union? And if so, would you agree that that potentially is a catalyst for gold and silver?
I think there's some real risks there. I'm not sure that they'll be realized, at least for the next several years. You know, I studied political science in school, and when I was in school, you know, really from the 1950s through into the mid-80s, the overriding political impulse was toward consolidation, ever bigger governments, ever bigger government and international organizations. And from the 80s forward, we started seeing really a devolution of power to ever smaller operations and governments and entities. And I think that I take Brexit and the vote for Brexit within that context. Now, obviously, there's this tremendous anti-government anger and frustration that was behind the British exit vote. It's behind the changes in the German electorate over the last few months and last weekend. It's behind votes that we've seen in the United States, the Philippines, Austria, and a number of other places. So there is a lot of anger there. But I think that, you know, my view of Brexit is that it's a sign of the times, that it's part of this greater devolution. And the risk that we have on a global basis is that the bureaucrats and politicians don't see it as such. And, you know, the reason why the British voted to leave the European Union was because the European Union had declined every opportunity to accommodate the British desire for a revised agreement between Britain and the EU. And I think that if you find that the politicians and bureaucrats sort of catch on to what's going on around the world, and they start responding to voters and the populations, then maybe you don't see that so much. But there is a risk there because, quite frankly, you know, with modern technology, with debit cards, with instant payment systems in places, the value of a European Union is far reduced from what it was, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So I think there is a scope for devolution. I'm not sure how fast it will come.
Moving on to the main event of precious metals, when we spoke back in May, it was about 3 or 4 weeks before the Brexit referendum. You predicted at the time that if Brexit passed, that it would result in a spike in gold and silver to the upside, and of course that's exactly what happened. But you and I both thought at that point that maybe that would be short-lived, that once the flash in the pan was over, similar to the way equities, you know, were way down but then corrected within a few days, we both thought that it might roll back over to the downside, down toward 1,200 or so. And I thought, until very recently, you know, it looked like maybe this trading range we've seen post-Brexit with support around 1,308, we almost took out last week, but boy, we're up to, what is it, 1,355 or so is we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. So has your view changed on gold? Where do you see it going from here?
Yeah, definitely our view has changed. You know, the realities that we're facing has changed. We thought that, yeah, you'd see a spike in the gold price going into the Brexit vote. If they voted to exit, it could be a slightly greater spike, but then we thought it would come back. It hasn't come back. We've seen investment demand in the United States, Canada, Europe, and a number of other countries hold up much more strongly than we had expected. Part of that is post-Brexit and post-Brexit anxiety. Part of it is, I think, a lot of anxiety about other economic and political factors, including the U.S. election. And I think that, you know, what we had been expecting was maybe a pause and a decline in gold prices in July, August, September. We're now into September. We haven't really seen that. We've seen a pause, but we haven't seen a decline. I think there is some scope for the gold price to drift down to 1,300 or even 1,280 over the next couple weeks. But I think with the enormous array of political and economic issues that are confronting investors around the world, gold will probably stay up higher. So, you know, we've said where we thought there would be a pause in the third quarter and then gold prices would rise a little bit more modestly in the fourth quarter and into 2017. We have the gold price staying higher now, and actually continuing, probably rising at a somewhat more accelerated pace between now and, say, 2018.
So it sounds like it's a buy signal from your standpoint.
Well, yeah, we've seen a really strong move off of the base. So I don't expect, just as I don't expect the dollar to rise as strongly as it was in 2015, I don't expect the gold price to rise as strongly as it did in the first half of this year. But I think that, you know, I divide investors in gold into different categories. And from a shorter-term capital appreciation perspective, I think gold makes sense because it's more likely to be higher in the next year or two or three than it is to be lower. And I think from a longer-term investment or capital preservation perspective, gold probably makes sense simply because of the economic and political and currency market unrest that we're likely to see. So, yeah, we're telling investors to buy gold. We're telling them to be ready that if they see the price dip over the next few weeks, that would probably be a very good buying opportunity. But that from a longer-term perspective, it probably makes sense to continue to hold your gold and to add to your gold portfolio.
And we're seeing silver also back at, well, just below $20 as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, but it had been above 20 over the last few days. Do you also see silver as a buy, or do you think it's maybe a little bit overdone here?
It's probably a little bit more overdone than gold. There is a tremendous amount of investor interest in silver right now. The price probably is, in our view, more likely to move sideways to slightly higher than it is to rise significantly sharply from here. You know, I think that a price in the 18 to 22 range over the next 12 months is a likely trading range. So right now we're right in the middle of that, and it's sort of like a hold but don't necessarily run out and buy. But if you see the price, you know, drift back down to $18, it's probably a buy on an intermediate term basis.
Okay, and I assume that your view you described already in the short to intermediate term, long-term view for gold and silver is higher in terms of macro drivers, or I don't want to assume that?
Yeah, I think there are a couple factors there. I mean, there are fundamentals that are kicking in that are more supportive of gold, also supportive of silver in the long term. And then I think you have to look at the macroeconomic environment. You know, the big fundamental that drives gold and silver prices higher or lower is investment demand. And investment demand is driven by economic and financial and political developments and expectations of developments. And our view is that, you know, over the next couple of years, we're facing some problems. But in the longer term, we're probably facing even larger fundamental economic and financial market problems that are going to cause wobbles in the stock market, wobbles in economic growth, problems in the currency markets, and that all of those factors probably will cause investors to buy more gold and silver going forward than they are right now. So we expect gold prices and silver prices to rise in the long run.
Let's go ahead and move on to some of the other macro issues then, and we can relate some of them to how they might affect gold as we continue. In terms of growth prospects, you know, we've heard an increasing number of voices really expressing concern about GDP growth, both domestically in the United States and globally. What do you see in terms of global growth outlook?
Yeah. You know, the way we look at it is world global growth right now is about 3.3%. Real GDP. In the U.S., we're probably looking at about, well, the most recent figure was about a 1.1% growth in the second quarter of this year. And so our view is that we probably are going to continue to see this sort of muddle through economic growth, subpar economic growth compared to what we saw in the period 2000 to 2007, and even lower than the growth that we saw in the 2010 to 2015 recovery. What we're looking for on a global basis is economic growth in the 3 to 3.3% range, which is what economists call a non-inflationary sustainable long-term growth profile. In the United States, we're looking at growth in the, you know, 0.5 to 2.0% growth rate over the next 10 years, which is, again, non-inflationary, but it doesn't necessarily get us out of the malaise that we're in right now. And we're sort of looking at that. And the problem is that when you have an economy, either a national economy like the U.S. or a global economy, when you have an economy that is just muddling through, it renders itself vulnerable to economic and financial shocks that can throw it back into a recession or could cause a spike higher in unemployment and other factors like that. So that is one of the factors that we're looking at that make us think that there will be periods of time over the next 10 years when investors will say economic conditions are really in dire straits. I should be adding more gold and silver to my portfolio.
And let's talk about interest rates, because obviously that definitely has a bearing on precious metals. What do you see? I mean, it seems like everybody keeps saying, well, surely this has to be the bottom in interest rates, and then interest rates just move lower from there. Deeply negative across a lot of Europe, and there's now more than $10 trillion of negative yielding sovereign debt around the world. Can this trend continue?
I think it can. You know, I one of the problems is that we're in uncharted territories in terms of financials and economic environment. And we've never really seen an extended period of time with massive negative interest rates on sovereign debt and negative interest rates on excess reserves in the monetary system in Europe, Japan, United States, just about every major economy. And there's a lot of things that are there that just have never been seen before. And part of the problem for everyone is to stop and say, you know what, we are in fact new territory, and the rules that we thought we could live by for 40, 50 years probably have changed. Some of those rules don't necessarily apply. So I look at the period of low real interest rate or low nominal rates in the United States, negative real interest rates, negative nominal rates in Europe and Japan and Switzerland. And I say, on a theoretic level, this probably isn't sustainable, but the theories probably no longer apply here. And the reality is that I think we could see an extremely long period of time with extremely low interest rates, simply because the system as we knew it in the post-war era no longer is operable.
Well, and certainly negative real interest rates bode very well for precious metals, because it means precious metals no longer have the objection of having to compete with something that's yielding if these other things are not yielding anything. What about the excess banking reserves? The banking system is carrying a large excess of reserves over what's required. What are the implications of that on economic growth?
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time in the first half of this year, the first 8 months of this year, looking at negative interest rates, low interest rates, and excess bank reserves, trying to make sense of it. And frankly, we can't make sense of it. And when we talk to people at others at various central banks and we talk to other economists, they can't really make sense or explain these things too. I mean, if you look at the excess reserves in the United States, right now we have about $2.3 trillion in excess reserves held primarily by large banks, half U.S. banks, half foreign banks, in the U.S. banking system. And the Fed is paying 25 basis points interest on that. It makes no sense to me for the Fed and everybody to be saying we need to stimulate growth, but yet we're paying people 25 basis points to hold excess reserves that otherwise would be lent out. And if you look at U.S. banking, and the same is true in Europe and Switzerland and Japan, you never had excess reserves before 2008. And in 2008, in the midst of the global financial crisis, the Fed started paying interest rates on monetary reserves. It didn't quite make sense to me then, and it certainly doesn't make sense to me now. And when you start talking to Fed policymakers and you say, why is it that you're paying 25 bips? If you want to stimulate lending, it doesn't make sense to raise your interest rates the way you've been saying to, based on a theory that's never been proven empirically to hold water. It makes sense to stop paying 25 basis points to banks for holding excess reserves and to jawbone them into increasing their lending. And the Fed has done neither of those things. So there's this big disconnect that we just don't understand. And, you know, like I said, $2.3 trillion in excess reserves in the United States, about $600 or $700 billion in excess reserves in Europe, about $600 billion in excess reserves in Switzerland, and then excess reserves in Japan and the UK. It just doesn't make sense for this to be going on. And I think that the matrix of interest rates and excess reserves is going to be a key factor in trying to determine how global economic conditions unfold going forward and what it means for stock market, for the bond market, and for gold and silver and other assets.
And I couldn't agree with you more. The Fed talks so much about how they want to get the banking system lending again while simultaneously they're providing a financial incentive to the banks not to lend, which just blows my mind. The backdrop, though, that we've been in for the last several years here is disinflation, if not outright deflation. Some people have opined that that is set to continue, that a deflationary spiral is beginning and will last for several years. Other people have said, hey, wait a minute, all of the major inflations in history were preceded by a whiff of deflation first, and we're about to see the reversal into runaway inflation. What do you think? Is it one of those? Is it somewhere in between? What's your outlook for deflation, inflation?
I think it's one or the other. You know, as long as we have this muddle through economy, I think we can have the disinflation that we've been seeing in the United States and the deflationary pressures that we've been seeing in Europe and Japan. And again, I think that one of the keys to understanding what's going to happen in the future is to understand that the past is not going to continue into the future. I mean, if you listen to policymakers in the industrialized world, they keep talking about, well, we should have 2% inflation, we should have, you know, 3% real GDP. And the reality in Europe, Japan, and the United States is we have aging populations. And those economic targets that people used were valid for growing economies with young populations. As the populations and the economic structures in the industrialized worlds mature, we should be seeing less inflationary pressures and slower growth, and that's what we're seeing. So I think part of the problem that we have is slow economic growth, but part of the problem that we have is policymakers who have expectations of too high of economic growth. So I think they're expecting too much of maturing, aging economies, and so they're putting undue pressures on it, and they're managing fiscal policy inappropriately. They should be gearing down and moving toward a slower growth, lower inflation period. In terms of inflation versus deflation, inflation comes from two places. One is excess money creation, and we have seen excess money creation, but all that money sitting in excess reserves. And the reason why we've been paying attention to excess reserves is if those policies change and those excess reserves become mobilized, that could have inflationary pressures. But we don't necessarily see monetary authorities changing those policies, at least for the next several years. So we think that those inflationary pressures are unlikely to come out, at least for the next several years. The other source of inflation is in the real economy, you know, the relationship between supply and demand of goods and services. And again, with a slow aging population and maturing economic structures, you're seeing continued growth in supply of goods and services and a slowdown in demand for those goods and services, which is causing deflationary pressures and disinflationary pressures. So we think that what we're going to see is continued low inflation, deflationary pressures, deflationary risks, and inflation is postponed indefinitely until something major changes, both in the way fiscal policy is run and the way monetary policy is run.
So just to summarize what you've said so far to make sure I've got it straight, it sounds like for a number of reasons, growing geopolitical tensions, the fact that we have this negative interest rate environment, there's a lot of good reasons to think that gold and silver are going to continue to do reasonably well. But the moonshot in prices that would occur if there were a sudden reversal from deflation into a runaway inflation trend where gold would suddenly outperform dramatically, that's really not on the radar, at least near horizon-wise. That might be coming several years down the road. Is that a good summary?
I think that's a good summary. It's a real risk, but it's a low-probability risk. And we're watching it, and we're telling our clients, and we're behaving, you know, personally, saying, look, you should have some insurance policy, i.e. gold and silver, set aside in case that money does become mobilized. But it's probably a low probability issue for the next several years, so the insurance policy should have a low premium at this point.
Okay. There's another growing opinion out there, a growing chorus of people, some very famous people, George Soros, Carl Icahn, Stan Druckenmiller, who have all come out and basically taken extremely bearish views on U.S. economy and U.S. equities. But, you know, frankly, Soros has had this opinion for a good solid year now, I think, and, you know, the tape just keeps marching higher. Do you think these guys are onto something? Are we looking at maybe this fall, a major tail risk of some kind of, you know, the beginning of the next 2008 kind of event, which it seems like a few people are predicting, or do you think this is overblown?
I think they're on to something. Again, like everybody else, I think they're struggling with trying to understand what's changed this time around. And so if you look at the stock market and the economy and the relationship between economic activity, interest rates, inflation, monetary aggregates, and the stock market, you would say that the stock market does seem overblown and that we are at a great risk of another major financial crisis and economic downturn. But a lot of this all comes back to those excess reserves, you know, and I think one of the things, well, I'll get back to that, instead of this cataclysmic thing, there may be a higher probability that what we see is continued muddle through, continued disinflation, and continued blah economic activity instead of a cataclysmic resolution. We do think that there'll be a recession in the United States, probably in 2018, you know, is the most probable period that we're looking for. But we think it could be a relatively mild recession, especially compared to the last one. So while the risk of a big recession and a major financial crisis is real and it's out there, we think a more likely scenario will be a less dramatic recession and some financial problems, but not as cataclysmic as we saw in 2008-2009. Now, going back to those excess reserves, we can't understand why the central banks are doing this. We can understand why the banks, the commercial banks, are doing it. A, in the United States, they're being paid to hold this stuff. You don't make a lot of money at 25 basis points, but if you have excess reserves, your required reserves are sort of quarantined, and those are what you have to keep and all. But the excess reserves can be hypothecated. And what you do is you lend out those excess reserves in a variety of high-yield products. So we think one of the reasons why you're seeing the stock market go from strength to strength or height to height is because of those excess reserves being available for large investors, private equity firms, and large corporations to take over mergers, to do stock buybacks, and to invest in the stock market in a variety of ways that yield them 5-6% or more on these excess reserves. And, you know, you go to Europe, the European Central Bank has said that the bond buying program that it will do, because there's starting to be questions about how many sovereign bonds are out there that the European central banking system can buy from investors to undertake quantitative easing and provide large-scale asset purchase programs to pump money into the European thing. The ECB has said that they will consider new corporate bonds. So as you look at Bayer looking to buy Monsanto, Bayer legally could go to the Bundesbank and sell it Bayer corporate bonds and use the proceeds to buy Monsanto, which will keep Monsanto shares and the Dow Jones that much higher. You know, and I think that when you look at the disconnect between falling interest rates and weak economic activity and low inflation and still high unemployment and very high underemployment, and you say, how is it that the stock market can be rising in this economic environment? I think a big part of the answer has to do with the mobilization of those excess bank reserves. And I think Soros and Druckenmiller and ICANN and everybody else are correct to be worried about it, but I also think that you have to take it into the context of what's really going on with all of these excess reserves at this time to understand, yes, there is an increased risk of this cataclysmic development, but unfortunately what we might see is a continuation of what we've seen over the last 15 months already.
Well, so it sounds like, although perhaps it is a low likelihood possibility, if something were to change, let's say we get a new president who you know, proclaims that they're going to start pressuring the Fed to stop paying banks for holding excess reserves because they want to get the banks lending to the people again, which would certainly be a popular message, that could be a really huge up signal, you know, buy signal for gold and sell signal for stocks based on what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that amazed me was a few months ago, Donald Trump was asked about, you know, his concerns about the federal debt. And he said, look, you know, we have incredible ability to borrow more money. Investors around the world are continuing to buy treasuries. And then he said, and if they ever don't want to hold these treasuries, we can renegotiate cents on the dollar. Now, that's a really frightening idea for the Treasury. You know, basically what you're saying is the Treasury would default and reschedule and say, look, guys, we're just not good for this. We'll give you 50 cents on the dollar or whatever. And when he said that, the markets didn't even blink. But if you had a new president who said, you know, look, this is what we got to do, yeah, it could really upset the apple cart very quickly.
I want to move on to some other geopolitical issues. You know, something I've noticed is just a general trend around global cooperation starting to fail. If you look at the G20 meeting last week, Obama shows up and it appeared that the Chinese intentionally forgot to set up an air stair for him to get off the airplane with. Meanwhile, they're greeting Putin with the red carpet treatment. What do you make of this trend in terms of failing global cooperation?
As I go around the world, I talk about, and I've talked about it for 20-some-odd years now, I think, the idea that you're moving to a period of ever greater breakdown in the post-war economic and political cooperation. Now, when I talk in the United States, I talk about reduced international cooperation. When I talk overseas, I talk about reduced U.S. hegemony over political, economic, currency, and financial issues. And that's what they understand. And what you're seeing is that the U.S. has been losing stature really for about 20 years, probably since the late Reagan era and the George H. Bush period. Clinton actually helped rebuild it by running surpluses for a few years. George W. Bush definitely hurt it, and Obama has definitely not helped it. And so the U.S. has continually lost status. I mean, doing as much work as I do in China, it is beyond a doubt in my mind that the Chinese consciously snubbed Obama. And then you had his face-to-face with Putin, where they were mimicking, you know, prize fighters in the pre-fight press conference, and then you had the problems with the Philippines president. So you definitely are seeing a diminution of respect for the U.S. government, and that's probably going to continue regardless of who wins the presidential election. And you're definitely seeing a breakdown in international cooperation.
Well, it's amazing, too. You know, I just saw today Mexico is firing the finance minister who set up the meeting with Donald Trump coming to meet the president of Mexico. There was an intercept Russian aircraft intercepting a U.S. spy plane over the Black Sea, supposedly 10-foot separation on a fast flyby. There was Iranian fast attack boats harassing U.S. military vessels. I mean, boy, it just seems like things are heating up.
Well, you saw NATO ran military exercises in the East Baltic last month, and the Russians expressed their discontent by flying over the plane ships that were in the East Baltic very closely. And the U.S. expressed chagrin that we would, you know, sail our boats right next to their shore, and they would take umbrage with it. At the same time we were doing that, we sailed two aircraft carrier battleships into the South China Sea. Now, the thing to remember is this. If you look at military hardware, the U.S. has like 19 aircraft battle ships and aircraft battle fleets. Russia has one. They can't even protect both of their coasts at the same time with the aircraft battle fleet. And China's building its first. So for the U.S. to send two aircraft carrier battle fleets into the South China Sea is to say to them, look, you may be building these islands, you may be claiming all of this sea for yourself, but let's look at who's got the power.
It's a scary trend, and certainly the presidential candidates, both of them, don't seem to be pacifists in terms of their foreign policy stance. I want to come back, though, to the trend that I'm concerned with in the United States, which is a really large number of young adults in the United States have begun to favor socialism. And I put socialism in quotes because, frankly, I'm not sure that they even understand what the word means. Something I've noticed is the view seems to be capitalism, which is what we have now, isn't working, and therefore we should try socialism. And, you know, I feel the opposite way, which is capitalism is what we should go back to because the system that we have now of increasing corruption and cronyism isn't working. But it seems like younger people really have this view that capitalism is bad and we need socialism. Are you concerned, and what do you think the impacts of that are going to be on financial markets going forward?
Well, I think I agree with you. I'm not so much concerned with socialism because I guess socialism has always been something that a lot of young people idealistically say they favor. I do think that we need a purer, more cleanly regulated form of capitalism. And my biggest concern is not with, you know, socialistic tendencies, but with fascist tendencies. And fascism is what you call cronyism. I mean, fascism really is state corporatism. The state exists to protect corporations. And we're seeing that, and we've seen it, you know, ever since the 1950s. I mean, Eisenhower warned about it with his military-industrial complex speech on his way out the door. He was seeing it take hold in the 1950s, and it's just gotten worse in through the 60s, 70s, and up until now. And it's gotten much worse, and it's not just in the United States, it's around the world. And you can call it fascism, or you can call it cronyism, or you can call it corrupt government, but it's all the same thing. And it actually gives capitalism a bad name. I kind of worry a little bit about socialistic tendencies, but I'm much more concerned about the older people and the people who are actually running the economy and the government right now and their fascist or cronyistic tendencies, because I think that those are much more detrimental, both in terms of overall economic activity, but also in terms of creating a political environment that doesn't lend itself to credible and healthy reform in terms of restoring capitalism and the sort of a well-regulated capitalist system, which is what we really need.
Actually, Jeff, I remember you told me a story off the air about this. Why don't you share it with our listeners?
Yeah, in March of 2009, I was giving a speech at the World Bank commodities conference at the World Bank. And this was about 2 weeks after Obama was inaugurated. And every place in the paper, all of the Republicans were talking about how Obama was a socialist and he was pursuing socialist policies, things like, you know, health care and democratization of government, things like that. And I was talking to a very prominent Republican that I knew in Washington, and I said, "You guys know that what he's proposing is not really socialism." And he said, "Of course." I said, "So why are you saying it?" And he said, "Well, in the 1930s, the National Socialists in Germany, they started gaining power in the Bundestag, and for 4 years between elections, they kept saying, 'You don't have to vote for the Nazis, you can vote for the socialists.'" And 4 years later, they took power in the Bundestag through the vote. They didn't take over the country. They were voted into power, which is something that's very important to remember when you talk about this cronyism and the rise of fascism and the rise of Nazism. They were voted into power. And they were voted into power by saying, "You don't have to vote for us. You can vote for the socialists." So this Republican was telling me this, and I said, "So you guys, the Republican Party, are taking your cues from the Nazis as to how to run your campaign?" And he said, "It worked for them." So, you know, when I listen to all this talk about, oh, my God, Hillary's a socialist, Obama's a socialist, and I know what socialism is, and that's not socialism. You know, it's more like cronyism, what we're seeing right now. You know, if you talk about health care reform, talk about the health care reform that Obama put in place and what it did for the insurance companies by basically demanding that everybody pay insurance but not opening up the insurance companies to competition on an intrastate basis for health insurance. You know, that's cronyism. That's not socialism. That's cronyism, and it's a payoff for the health insurance industry. When I hear all this talk about socialism, it's not socialism. What it is Republicans trying to scare people who don't know socialism from cronyism.
Well, and to be sure, I agree with you that it's not socialism in a real definition of socialism. But what we have now sure ain't free market capitalism like we once had in this country. That's for sure.
Absolutely not.
Let's move back to your comments about the military-industrial complex and the impact that that's had. Hillary versus Donald in terms of who takes the presidency, what would you see the implications being for markets and particularly for gold?
Let's start with Donald because he's the harder one to respond to. You have no idea. because you have no idea who this guy is and what he's going to do and what kind of policies he would pursue. I think that he would be problematic for the global economy and for the U.S. economy. He seems to be a very uninformed person who tends to shoot from the hip, and I would be very much concerned about that. I did, in a speech in South Africa last month, say that I thought that Hillary would probably be more bullish for gold. And I say that because I look at her as part of this cronyism that's been growing for decades, and I think that she would be she would not do anything to help the global economy or the U.S. economy or U.S. middle class families or the unemployed and the underemployed. In addition to which, she's extremely militaristic, and she has basically promised starting 1, 2, 3 fights, you know, wars during the primary season, and you look at the people that she's gathering around her, they're all militaristic. You know, she's got the support of people within the CIA and the military who really want to attack Syria. They even want to send in snipers to shoot at Russian and Iranian soldiers in Syria, and they've talked about how they should be targeting Assad with bombs, which is illegal. It's a war crime on a global basis. So I think that she would be extremely detrimental for global peace. She would be extremely militaristic. We'd see more wars. We'd see more U.S. interventionism, and we would see a further deterioration in U.S. stature all around the world, all of which would help accelerate that investor conclusion that investors should hold fewer dollars and more gold. So I think that she would probably be much more bullish for gold than Donald would be, at least initially. You know, it could be that once Donald got into power, he would be doing things that would drive gold wild. But you just don't know. With her, you can pretty well be sure that she'd be good for gold.
And I want to move on to another topic before we get too political here, which is just the future of energy. You know, I think a lot of our listeners understand that although right now we're in a major glut of too much crude oil in the market, it's a temporary phenomenon, and eventually we are going to face a peak oil scenario. What do you see in the long run in terms of hydrogen economy, fuel cells, and so forth?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk right now that fuel cells and electric cars and hydrogen economy are going to keep oil prices down forever, and that's not going to happen. And I almost should defer to you on the oil market because I know you spend a lot of time looking at it. But the reality is that we're going to be very much dependent on hydrocarbons, oil and natural gas, for decades and decades to come. And, you know, electric vehicles, our projection is that 10 years from now, electric vehicles might represent 10% of new car sales. Or, I mean, I'm sorry, 5%. So that's a very small chink in the hydrocarbon market. There are some developments with hydrogen that are interesting. Fuel cells don't make sense to us. Battery technology still doesn't make a lot of sense to us. It's gotten better, but it's still very problematic. And I think that the transition away from hydrocarbons to other energies is going to be extremely slow. We are seeing a lot of technological developments, but those technological developments are competing with each other, so it's hard to say how it's all going to shake out.
Yeah, it's something I definitely have noticed is I think a lot of people and a lot of investors are just so affected by the experience of the computer revolution that they perceive technology as inherently advancing very quickly. And the thing they don't understand is there's no Moore's Law for batteries. You know, it has to do with getting more semiconductors onto a chip. It doesn't help with the battery problem. And I look at something like Tesla, and yes, Teslas are really cool cars. You know, if I was going to buy a car, I would consider having one. But if you look at the market capitalization of that company, the market is basically anticipating that they're going to make more cars than Ford. And, you know, it's not going to happen. There's not enough lithium to build all the batteries for that. So, you know, it's going to be a long, long time before we see the kind of adoption of electric cars that so many people seem to think is just around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, electric cars are coming, but they're coming very slowly, and the technologies are all up for redefinition. I'm a pessimist about fuel cells. I just think the technology is unproven and too expensive and cumbersome. I'm much more interested in hydrogen engines. There's been a lot of interesting research done on hydrogen engines. We're actually involved with a company that has the technology to use liquid organic compounds to carry hydrogen. So you can hydrogenate these organic compound liquids. You can ship the hydrogen as hydrogenated organic liquids that are actually less flammable than gasoline. You can use filling stations to pump and recover the stuff. And that saves you the $40 trillion of hydrogen distribution and storage facilities that you need to build to have, you know, hydrogen vehicles. But that technology is unproven. It's still in the laboratory stage. There's one company that has moved a little bit forward on it, but they're using hydrocarbons to carry as the liquid organic carrier. So you can't, you know, you can't get a byproduct of gasoline refining and use it to replace gasoline. It doesn't work that way. But that technology is decades and decades away. And in the meantime, we're still going to be using hydrocarbons, petroleum, natural gas, and nuclear power. So I think, you know, it's interesting, and there's going to be some very disruptive technologies. They will come across about fast by their standards, but that fast is going to be defined in decades, not years.
Jeff, you know, there's about 20 more topics that I would just love to dive into you with, but unfortunately, we are out of time for today's interview. Before we close, I know that at CPM Group, most of your best research is really reserved for your paying clients. A lot of people don't realize, though, that you have a section on your website where you make a lot of your research papers actually free to anyone who wants them. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, if you go to our website, which is cpmgroup.com, there's a section across the top called Our Market Views. And in that section, we have presentations that we've made, some of our older reports, press releases on some of our yearbooks and things. And there's also special sections. So, that, you know, because, as you know, I hate to talk about gold and silver conspiracies, we have sections debunking, providing evidence that debunks the gold and silver conspiracies. So when people say, well, talk to me about these things, say, no. Just go to our website. There's free stuff there. You can read it and download it. But there's all sorts of other things. There's stuff about, there's an article like Why Bullion Banking Explained, which explains how bullion banks trade big gold and silver, which is something that a lot of people don't understand. There's another section, I think, on why derivatives don't matter to you and me. So there's a whole lot of free reads there in the Our Market Views section of our website.
And I think we've got a sample of one of those pieces that we've already sent our registered users at macrovoices.com in their research roundup email this week. We'll try to get a link in to that section of the website. For our institutional listeners that might be interested in some of your research products, give us a quick overview of what you do at CPM Group.
Right. Well, we do a lot of research. We do research on precious metals, but we also do specialty metals. We're doing some work on, right now we're talking to a major institution about a work on what we call energy metals, because lithium, vanadium, manganese, cobalt, all of these metals could go one way or the other dramatically depending on whether or not the technologies that would use them get commercialized or get replaced with other technologies. We do a lot of basic research. We also have a group that will help investors invest not only in the basic commodities but also in commodity-producing companies. We have another group that works on hedging strategies for producers and consumers of commodities. And we have a couple of investment banking professionals who help match interested institutional and high-net-worth individual investors with interesting projects. So we're working on a variety of investments in gold, silver, hydrogen, a thing called compressed air energy storage right now, which is a very interesting technology that's been grossly overlooked for about 130 years. Lithium, iridium, you know, so there are a variety, and helium interestingly enough. So we have a lot of stuff that's actually oriented at the financial management of exposure to commodities.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Great interview, Eric. Jeff Christian is obviously best known as a precious metals expert, but I really enjoy his perspective on the broader macro picture as well. So we announced a few weeks ago that we'd be taking listener requests for topics that we'll discuss after the featured guest interview, but we haven't received many requests. So listeners, be sure to let us know if there's a topic you want us to cover. Meanwhile, I'm going to seize the opportunity and focus this week's discussion on one of my own favorite topics, reserve currencies. Now, you hear the phrase reserve currency thrown around all the time, but frankly, I think most people, now including professionals on Wall Street, don't have a clue or even a very deep understanding of its meaning. So, Eric, let's start with what the phrase reserve currency means and why it's important in the first place.
Well, there's really two common uses of that term, reserve currency, and I agree with you that most people only seem to know the first one. So let's take them in order. The first definition really would be better termed the international trade settlement currency. In other words, if you're going to have international trade, it would be very inefficient to do it in all of the different currencies of all of the different countries involved. If you were going to import your wine from France and pay for it in French francs or now in euros, and import your tea from China and have to pay for that in Chinese renminbi, and import your tacos from Mexico and have to pay in pesos for that, that would mean everybody has to have a whole bunch of every single different currency lying around in order to resolve international trade. This was more important 50 years ago than it was today, because in those days, if you didn't have any pesos and needed to buy something from Mexico in pesos, it could be a complex transaction to go and get some pesos. So for that reason, basically, it was agreed that everybody needed to pretty much pick one currency that would be used to settle most, if not all, international trade. The U.S. dollar serves in that role, and it really is the international trade settlement currency, although people often use the phrase reserve currency to refer to that meaning. I would also observe that it's not as important as it used to be, because these days you can buy those pesos. If you wanted to do business with Mexico in pesos, at the click of a mouse in, you know, less than a second, you can buy those pesos and do the international foreign exchange transaction on a computer terminal. So I don't think that function of having to have all international trade settled in the same currency is nearly important in modern times as it was a few decades ago, when we didn't have this immediate ability to transact forex transactions.
Right. So the first definition is that the global reserve currency is what's used to settle international trade transactions. Now, it could be in cash or U.S. Treasury bills and bonds. Regular listeners will recall from Jeff Snyder's excellent interview on the global euro-dollar system that global treasury holdings are actually falling. So that's interesting to point out. But you said that the second definition was actually more important. So what's that second definition and why is it more important?
This is where we really get to the phrase reserve currency. What it's referring to is central banks of all the governments around the world have to hold reserve assets. Think of that as the savings account for a country. Why do they need to have that savings account? If something happens, if something goes wrong with international trade and suddenly that country's currency is losing value against other currencies, it's collapsing in value, the central bank has to intervene to defend the currency. The way they do that is by buying their own currency on the open market. Well, they can't buy their own currency unless they have some other currency to pay for it with. Back in the good old days, gold was the central bank asset of choice. The way that central banks held reserves was to have gold bullion in a vault someplace. So it's an interesting story of how the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency. And the answer is, back in 1944, the Bretton Woods Accord basically made the U.S. dollar interchangeable with gold. So it was effectively U.S. dollars are as good as gold. And that was accomplished through the Bretton Woods Accord, where the United States made a promise to the rest of the world that forever and all time, you can trust us, we'll never renege on our word. The U.S. dollar will be convertible by international holders to gold bullion for anybody who wants to convert it at a fixed rate of exchange of $35 per ounce, which will never change. We promise, absolutely, cross our hearts, hope to die, no matter what. Until, that is, President Nixon in 1971 said, we were actually only kidding about that. And actually what President Nixon said at the time was that he was going to suspend temporarily the convertibility of U.S. dollars into gold by international holders because it was necessary in order to thwart the wrongdoings perpetrated by speculators who he was blaming for this action. Of course, in reality, it was the U.S. overspending on the Vietnam War that was resulting in a lot of people realizing that U.S. dollars were not worth as much as the gold they were convertible for. And so there was essentially a run on the gold holdings of the United States. So the U.S. basically broke its promise. Why then? What a lot of people thought this would mean back in the 70s, it was August 15th of 1971 that President Nixon made that announcement, was basically, okay, this means that the U.S. dollar will no longer be the reserve currency because it's not convertible into gold anymore, and that was the whole reason for making it the reserve currency back in 1944. The thing is, Tina, there is no alternative. If you're not going to use U.S. dollars as the world's reserve asset currency, what would you use instead? I suppose the argument might have been to go back to gold bullion, but as we talked about in a previous show, Henry Kissinger was successful at negotiating the petrodollar agreement with the Saudis and with other Arab oil producers, and the U.S. dollar has remained the de facto reserve currency, even though the Bretton Woods agreement broke down with Nixon slamming the gold window in 71. And, of course, as we talked about after, I think it was Gary Schilling's interview, there's a gentleman in Russia called Sergei Glazyev who wants very badly to change that. But for now, the U.S. dollar is and will likely remain the world's reserve currency.
Yeah, hearing you describe it just sounds like the world's biggest bait and switch. So the second and most important definition of reserve currency is that it is the currency in which central banks reserve assets, effectively the savings account of a sovereign nation, are denominated, and hence the name reserve currency. But let's not stop there. What are the implications of the U.S. dollar being the reserve currency, both for the U.S. and for other nations around the globe?
Well, what happens is it creates a massive artificial demand for the reserve currency. Everybody needs to have dollars because both to settle international trade and to have that savings account, they have to have dollars. That artificial demand for dollars effectively allows the issuing country, the United States, to run huge current account deficits. So you can have a massive trade deficit importing all kinds of stuff from other countries, not balancing that by exporting the same amount of stuff to other countries. Normally, that would have horrific adverse consequences. But essentially, the United States gets a get-out-of-jail-free card and gets away with running a huge current account deficit without having to pay the penalty for it. And as we've discussed before, this is what Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the former finance minister and later president of France, called exorbitant privilege, the United States' unique ability to effectively go into debt for free. And, you know, he didn't like that, but he couldn't do anything to change it.
Now, Eric, you said D'Estaing didn't like the fact that the U.S. had this, as you say, exorbitant privilege, but he couldn't do anything about it. And our regular listeners will recall that we talked about Sergei Glazyev and Robert Triffin after Gary Schilling's feature interview a couple of weeks ago. And I'd recommend that interested listeners go back to that conversation for more perspective and details on how this fits into the story. But for the sake of listeners who missed that conversation, we just barely have time for a quick summary. So, Eric, give us the Coles notes here.
Oh, boy. It's a big topic to do Cliff Notes on. But Sergei Glazyev, again, a Russian scholar, advisor to Vladimir Putin, very well-known man in Russia, ran for president of Russia, I think it was in 94, sometime in the 90s. And he's very well-known there. It was actually interesting. We brought him up, I think it was on the Gary Schilling show, and we got two emails from listeners. One guy in Russia said, thank you so much. I'm so impressed that you know one of the most important and well-respected scholars in our country. Thank you for mentioning him. That's great. Another guy, I assume, is a Russian living somewhere other than Russia, because he said back home, that guy Glazyev is so badly not respected, you shouldn't even mention him because you'll lose credibility with Russian listeners if you do. So well, from these two contrasting things, I can only conclude that Russia has politics too, and Glazyev is either loved or hated depending on who you talk to in Russia. In any case, what his recent fame has been associated with is he's proposed this de-dollarization strategy, effectively trying to persuade the other BRICS countries to abandon trade settlement in U.S. dollars and transact business in some other currency. Now, I think that's because Glazyev's a very smart guy. He knows the more important issue is not trade settlement, but reserve assets. The thing is, that's a tougher nut to crack because there's no other alternative. You know, there's no bond market deep and liquid enough to absorb central bank sized capital flows other than the U.S. Treasury market. So he's focusing on the easier nut, trying to persuade other countries to do their transactions not in dollars, but in something else. And I think eventually he probably will lobby for reserve assets. There's been some speculation that China and Russia might jointly sponsor a gold-backed currency. You know, nobody in the West takes any of this stuff seriously. Frankly, I think they should. It's not going to happen overnight. But we've got two massively important countries that are starting to work together to try to undo the hegemony that the U.S. dollar enjoys in the international monetary system. I think that's an important thing. Who's Robert Triffin, 1950s economist? He described a paradox. What's the paradox? Essentially, what Triffin said is, how do you decide what's going to be the reserve currency in the first place? Well, it has to be what's the best credit. Without a doubt, in 1944, time of Bretton Woods, the United States dollar was clearly the best credit because the United States was the biggest creditor nation in the world. Well, what did Triffin predict? He said, if you make a country the reserve currency issuer, what it does is it enables that country to basically engage in massive overborrowing, living and borrowing and spending beyond their means, and engaging in what Triffin, when he predicted it back in the 1950s, he termed military adventurism. And starting with Vietnam, needless to say, the U.S. has had its share of military activity since then. Triffin predicted that this would result in the reserve currency issuer, that is the United States, transitioning over time from being the best credit to the worst credit, and therefore no longer worthy of that reserve currency status. And of course, what's happened in that time? The U.S. has gone from being the biggest creditor nation in the world to the biggest debtor nation in the history of the world. So Triffin got it right. What he predicted is eventually the reserve currency issuer has to lose that reserve currency status someday because it will eventually become the worst credit and no longer worthy of that status. Sergei Glazyev knows this, and he's trying to be the guy that is the catalyst to start the international movement that would eventually strip the United States of its exorbitant privilege and its reserve currency status. Obviously, big ships take a long time to change course, so this is not going to happen overnight. Nobody takes Glazyev seriously in the West, and I think they should. He's not going to change the world overnight, but, you know, he might be the guy who started something. Does that make Glazyev a terrorist of economic warfare, or does that make him a freedom fighter who's engaged in righting a terrible injustice of the U.S. having this hegemony over the rest of the global financial system? Well, I guess that depends on your perspective and which country you're sitting in. A lot of people in the world would probably see him as the freedom fighter. The United States is going to see him as a threat.
Eric, that's fascinating stuff. And really, no matter the perspective you take, I think what's for certain is that the tectonic plates of the global monetary system are in motion. And with China's upcoming inclusion in the SDR on October 1st, the yuan's ascension as a global reserve currency will be, I think, one of the most important storylines of this century. Now, having said that, we're looking forward to interviewing some China-centric experts in the near future to discuss this monumental shift. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Listeners, we're not quite sure what to make of the fact that you guys aren't requesting topics for the segment. Is that because you preferred the old format with Eric and I discussing the feature interview guest, or maybe you didn't realize we were taking requests in the first place? We'd really love to hear from you in our listener discussion forum at macrovoices.com, where there's a very quiet thread titled Request Thread Post Guest Interview Topics. Now, please make a request for future topics there. You can also reach out to us directly on Twitter. If you don't enjoy the new format, let us know why not so we can consider changing it. Eric, anything else before we wrap up the show?
Well, just the usual broken record. I want to start with a shout-out to thank Tyler Durden at Zero Hedge. Zero Hedge once again picked up our Labor Day weekend with Art Berman and did a feature article on that, which we tremendously appreciate. It brought us some additional traffic to the website. And that additional traffic, you know, the more that we grow, the more that that helps us to bring bigger and better guests to the program. We need your help, too, listeners. Please retweet us when we announce the show. Tell your friends about Macro Voices, particularly those of you who have access to some of the people we're trying to get to. What we're finding is that a lot of guests, Art Berman sent me an email saying he's hearing from his clients that the Macro Voices interviews are by far the highest quality interviews of any of the stuff that he does anywhere else. So it really feels great to have that positive feedback. The problem is when we reach out to a guy like Kyle Bass, his handlers have still never heard of us. So for those of you, and I know you do exist in our listener audience, who have access to Kyle Bass, who have access to some of the other big names that we've been trying to get to, let them know that Macro Voices is a little bit different than the average podcast run by a teenager and that it really is worth their time, because that's where we need your help the most, folks, is getting through those people. One of the biggest ways that you can help us, whether you have those contacts or not, is to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefits of registering, number one, you help us. The more registered users we have, the more able Aaron is to recruit the very best guests for the program. Second benefit, you'll automatically receive our research roundup emails. That gives you a compendium of links, both to presentations from our featured interview guest, as well as to the best free research that we could find on the internet every single week. If you don't want it, it takes one click to opt out of it with the safe unsubscribe link, so don't let that stop you from registering. Aaron, let's let people know what's in this week's research roundup.
Right. So this week we've got a full course of links that includes investor letters and company presentations to share with you guys. Now, I particularly enjoyed Hummingbird Partners' investor letter, tennis analogies notwithstanding, in which they not only present some interesting statistical data on the 162-year trend of lengthening expansions and shortening contractions, but also delve into why this might be the case and shine a harsh light on the questionable statistical assumptions that underpin traditional economic and financial thought. I highly recommend this read. And for those of you who are more interested in the oil and gas space, we have Enterprise Product Partners' slide deck from the recent presentation at the Citi MLP Midstream Infrastructure Conference. Finally, we've also got the latest from Jeff Snyder, Jesse Felder, Marin Katusa, and Rick Rule. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at _AaronChan_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.